The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, there's no sort of check the boxes kind of quote unquote career development or anything like that that exists in the creative life. And I think sometimes people think that there is and that they're not doing it right. And is no right.
Greetings, scribes, and welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you positivity, productivity, and creative flourishing in 2021. This week, award-winning New York Times bestselling author Danny Shapiro chatted with me about the Groundhog's Day effect of the pandemic, the transition from fiction to memoir, and the hidden power of family secrets. Danny is the author of 10 books, including the instant New York Times bestselling memoir Inheritance, published in 2019. Her other books include memoirs Hourglass, Still Writing, Devotion, and Slow Motion, as well as 5 novels. Inheritance won the 2019 National Jewish Book Award, was named one of Wired's top science books of 2019, and a best book of 2019 by Vanity Fair. The New Yorker called Inheritance a meditation on what it means to live in a time when secrecy, anonymity, and mystery are vanishing. Danny has taught at Columbia and New York University, is the co-founder of the Sirenland Writers Conference in Positano, Italy, and teaches writing workshops around the world. In early 2019, Danny also launched an original podcast, Family Secrets, in collaboration with iHeartMedia. In iTunes Top 10 Podcast, the series features stories from guests who, like Danny, have uncovered life-altering and long-hidden secrets from their family's past. And stay tuned for a special offer from this week's sponsor, Neuro. In this file, Danny and I discussed how to change the rhythm of your day to spark creativity, her mentors and awakening to her writing voice, learning to write in public, and find an agent along the way. On throwing out hundreds of pages, the power of storytelling in the aftermath of family trauma, and much more. Stay safe and stay sane out there. A new day is dawning. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published. And leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts to help other writers find us. All right, we're back on The Writer Files. I am honored to be joined by the peerless Danny Shapiro. Thanks for taking time to do this today.
Oh, thanks, Kelton. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How are you surviving these bizarro and somewhat catastrophic times?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's so much trembling in the world right now, but in terms of the pandemic, I find it's bizarrely, it hasn't really changed my rhythms as a writer, but that's not really true because I was in the midst of a really long book tour involving a huge amount of travel right up until, you know, when COVID got to the U.S. And of course, like everybody else, everything was canceled. So I went from like having so much more travel left to do for my most recent book, including international travel that I was really psyched about. I was going to go on I was going to Paris on book tour for the French edition. And I've never done that before. And I was so excited about that. And then I was supposed to go to the Sydney Writers Festival. Super excited about that.
That's although, so cool. Yeah.
Although daunting too. I mean, it was so much travel that when it all got canceled, even though I was disappointed, it's also my natural habitat. I wonder if you or, you know, other writers would identify with that. Like I have the muscles for solitude, which a lot of people, you know, don't necessarily have because they haven't had to exercise them.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And as so many authors discussed during this very interesting time in history, you have the ability obviously to be in isolation, and obviously we you know, solitude is just part and parcel with the creative process. But, yeah, I mean, so many authors I talk to right now are in the middle or in the midst of, you know, like virtual book tours, which is a completely different kind of weird anomaly of these times.
Yeah, I mean, the remainder of my book tour definitely did morph into virtual events, which I'm still doing. And those are very strange, I think in large part because so much of being with readers is that sort of exchange of energy, you know, reading in front of a crowd or speaking or being in conversation or being on a panel. There's such a great, beautiful exchange of energy that happens, and you just don't feel it when you're on Zoom or, you know, doing a virtual appearance. It's, it can be really pretty strange and unmooring. But the other thing I want to say, because I don't want anybody, yes, the isolation I'm familiar with and I don't mind. And the solitude is, you know, kind of just a prerequisite for, you know, a creative life in many ways. But I have had a really hard time writing since the start of the pandemic. I mean, I can do projects. If I have an assignment to write an essay, I will write the essay. And I don't think it's affected my work, but I think it's affected my concentration. So that starting something new in the midst of a time when the ground is shifting so much in the world, I have found really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting because it can't help. I mean, it's obviously going to bleed into your subconscious a little bit, and then it can probably throw off some of those rhythms. But then there's that kind of Groundhog's Day feeling of this this pandemic, where it's like, you know, I've heard many writers lament not being able to go to a coffee shop and just
totally,
you know, sit there and something about the sound of a coffee shop kind of sparks creative ideas. And
totally. I'm such a coffee shop writer, and I miss that so much, because it's also just the ability to change your rhythm in your day. You know, like if you're stuck, to go to a cafe or you know, to you know, just change location, or you know, that's the thing. And also for me, when I'm reading something for work, either because I'm reviewing it or a book of a guest that I'm having on my podcast, I really like to be out doing that. I don't prefer to be sitting at home reading. I love that din of being around other people, and to not be able to do that, and the sameness as you describe is, I think, challenging for a lot of us.
Yeah.
Certainly for me.
Yeah. Sure. Definitely. I'm unnerving at times. Well, let's talk about your superhero origin story a little bit and just wind back the clock and just take us back, because as a, you know, you, I guess you've written 10 books now, or published 10 books. You're an award-winning author, best-selling memoirist, and Inheritance, you know, was an instant New York Times bestseller. Take us back to kind of your journey here, because, you know, obviously you've done a lot of different things. You've taught, you've had all kinds of different creative experiences. Tell us a little bit about just kind of about that journey in a nutshell.
Yeah, I love talking about the journey, because every writer's journey is different. And, you know, there's no sort of check the boxes kind of quote unquote career development or anything like that that exists in the creative life. And I think sometimes people think that there is, and that they're not doing it right, and is no right. You know, I have a writer's conference that I founded and created with my husband, and also with our partner and friend, Hannah Tinti, the editor of One Story, that meets every year in Italy. And on the opening night of, not the opening night, but early in the conference, it's a week-long conference called Sirenland, we have everyone who's teaching there get up and tell their origin story, essentially. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it's one of my favorite evenings at the conference, because whether it's Meg Wolitzer or Anthony Doerr or Jess Walter or Andre Aciman or Andre Debuse or Susan Orlean, or, you know, it goes on. Every story is different. every single, Tobias Wolff, you know, every single story is different. And even year to year, when some people return to teach, the story changes. So anyway, as a preamble to that, so I grew up in suburban New Jersey in a world where I did not know any writers. I didn't know it was possible to become a writer. I didn't know any artists. And when I went to college, I was fortunate enough to stumble into the right school for me, which was Sarah Lawrence, which is a small liberal arts school, you know, just north of New York City, that had a lot of writers teaching there, partly because of its history, and partly because it was within commuting distance of the city. So when I first got there, I started meeting working writers for the first time. Grace Paley was teaching there. Russell Banks had just taught there. E.L. Doctorow had taught there. There were all sorts of just amazing, you know, like, you know, to this day, Marie Howe teaches there, Victoria Riddell, Mary Morris, and Joanne Beard. And so it was this eye-opening experience, not in the sense that I thought, oh, I can be a writer, but just I realized that a writing life was possible for some people, and I was meeting them. And then when I was like sort of well into college, and I had left for a while and come back, I had a kind of peripatetic college experience. I had a crisis, a tragedy really, in my family, where in which my parents were in a very serious car crash that killed my father and badly injured my mother. And something happened to me around that time, and the loss of my dad and grieving him. I had been writing, but I hadn't found my way. I'd been writing short stories. I hadn't found my way into a story that wouldn't let me go, in a way. And even though I wasn't remotely ready to write the story of my family and my parents' accident and what it did to me, because I was a very kind of messed up young woman at the time, and it kind of woke me up in a huge way. And I wanted to be able to find a way to write about that in fiction. So when I went back to Sarah Lawrence after my father's death and while my mother was recovering, I started writing my first novel. And I should say, actually, I was there my senior year, and then it was Grace Paley who said to me, you know, you are a writer. There is the door to the graduate writing program. Go through it. And I, you know, literally walked through the door and ended up at Sarah Lawrence in graduate school in the MFA program. And I remember that first semester in the MFA program, one of my professors was frustrated with me, and I was frustrated with myself, because I basically kept on writing the same version of a short story over and over again. And she wrote, you know, and as a professor myself, I understand how hugely impactful these things can be that we don't even realize are impactful in the moment that we say. And she wrote in the margin of this story, "I think it's on to the novel." And I was like, what? You know, it was so scary to me, the thought of embarking on a novel while in graduate school. You know, I think there's a reason why so few, you know, so many more story collections come out of MFA programs than novels, right? Because to be in your first semester or your second semester and think, I'm going to put all of my eggs in this basket, and if I fail, it's not like one story out of eight that I wrote didn't work, or two or four. The whole thing, you know, is for naught. And so a lot of people just don't do it. It's too scary. And also, I think a lot of professors don't really know how to teach, how to workshop the novel.
And as I mentioned, this week's episode is sponsored by Neuro. Neuro makes functional gum and mints that help you better your mind and do more. Launched by athletes with backgrounds in neuroscience and chemistry, imagine health supplements you could easily carry around in your pocket and take on the go throughout the day instead of having to gulp down a bunch of pills in the morning. The great thing is these patented cold compressed gum and mints are gluten-free, sugar-free, vegan, and work a lot faster than drinks and supplements. They're loved by Olympians, engineers, academics, fitness heads, and creatives like you and me, stuck at home staring at the screen. The energy and focus products have been shown to improve brain performance in a pilot study out of the Harvard Innovation Lab. And the new Calm and Clarity line uses ingredients scientifically shown to reduce stress and stabilize mood. Because they're gum and mints, they're easy to carry, taste great, and give you fresh breath. I honestly love them because they take the stress out of having to brew or find that cup of coffee or tea during the lull in the day that we could all use a boost. And a little easier on the wallet. Head over to getneuro.com to order and better your state of mind now. That's GetNeuro.com. GetNeuro.com. Use the code WRITER to get 15% off your first order today.
But I went on to the novel and I had it in my head. Because again, as I said, I was really, I had been in this really messed up, lost place in my life when my dad died. I had it in my head that I was going to write that novel and I was going to sell that novel before I graduated. Like I had a lot to prove to myself. This is not, I don't recommend to anyone that they think the way that I did, but that's how I thought. And that's what happened, which is, wow. A highly unusual thing. One of my professors, a wonderful writer and teacher named Jerome Badanis, was his girlfriend, who later became his wife, was an editor at Crown. And Jerry gave it to her to read. I didn't know he was doing that. And she read it and she loved it and she wanted to buy it. And she, instead of just trying to buy it, she said, you should get a literary agent. And so I knew nothing about agents, and a friend of mine who was reading a magazine at the time saw a picture of a few literary agents in this article about, you know, big agencies, the players in big agencies moving around. And based on the photograph, she said to me, this woman looks like she will understand your work. She looks like she's been in psychoanalysis. She will understand your work. So based on that really careful research that I did and self-education, I picked up the phone and called this woman. I mean, I did everything wrong. And she was a very powerful, very scary person. And her assistant put me through to her. I think it helped that I said, you know, I'm in this MFA program and I have interest in my novel, you know, from a publisher. And I told her about it. I just kind of sputtered out whatever I said. And she said, I'll take a look at it. And I was living in New York City at the time. I walked it down to her office and left it there.
That's amazing.
And she called me the next day and she had read it overnight. And she said, can you come in, you know, tomorrow at 3 o'clock or whatever
it
was.
Wow.
I know. And I did. And she said, I think I can sell your book. And she did. And not to Crown, actually, to Doubleday. And so that was the beginning of my writing life. But the thing that I really want to say is that that book wasn't ready. It wasn't ready. I was impatient. I was rushing. I had a lot to prove. And, you know, some people liked that book and it got perfectly respectable reviews when it came out. But it wasn't ready. It was a kind of semi-autobiographical novel. I was not remotely in control of it. And I went on to publish two more novels after that first novel, you know, over the span of the next 6 or 7 years. And it really wasn't until, and those first three books, a lot of people don't even know about because they're out of print and I have no interest in them being back in print. I was learning how to write in public. And it wasn't until my first memoir, Slow Motion, which came out in 1998, that I started to actually kind of wrest control to whatever degree a writer ever has control, really, over my material. And the reason why I wrote a memoir wasn't because, oh, I thought it's a good idea to write a memoir, or memoirs are suddenly hot. I've never had that kind of thought in my life as a writer. It was because I became aware that in those first three novels that the image that I always have of this is, you know, when you see somebody walking their dog, but their dog is walking them, you know, like my novels were walking me. Like I never found, and I think that's fine in a first draft, that should happen, but I didn't know how to pull back and how to get the work to heal, you know? Mm. And I thought, I had a hunch that the reason was that my own autobiographical material, I needed to find a way to craft it as memoir, that it didn't want to be fictionalized. It wanted to be, written out of memory. And that's what I did. And that's actually the book that really got significant attention, for the first time. And then I went back to fiction and I wrote two more novels, my novel, Family History and my novel Black and White. I moved to Knopf as my publisher, who are my publisher, still today. And they were much stronger novels. They were the first kind of mature novels, if I can be any kind of judge of my own work. and then after that, I was expecting to continue to write fiction. And instead, my creative impulses moved back to memoir. And I didn't want them to. I mean, I remember, you know, I wait between books. I wait despairingly thinking, now the next one will never arrive. I always feel that way. I feel that way after 10 books. I always feel like, well, maybe that's it. And it's despair. You know, it's a feeling of just finding a way to be patient, but really feeling quietly despairing. And in that despair, what emerged was another memoir. And I remember, can I curse on your show?
Oh, of course.
So I remember I was practicing yoga one day, and the word devotion literally just kind of, I saw the word devotion in front of me and I knew what it meant. That's never happened to me before, but I knew that it was the title of my next book, and I knew that that meant it was a memoir, and I knew that it was a kind of existential, spiritual sort of quest kind of book. And all I mean, I said aloud, I was like, oh shit, like, this is not what I want to do. but it's what wanted to be done. And so I wrote devotion, and then I expected to return to fiction. And actually I did, you know, you said 10 books that I've published.
Yeah.
There was about 100 pages of novel after devotion, in which, though I loved the characters, I had kind of written myself into a corner and I put it in a drawer. It may come out of that drawer, but it's been in the drawer for 10 years. And then I wrote a craft and process book called Still Writing. It's like a little companion to creative people, as the way that I thought of it. And then I wrote Hourglass, my memoir about time and marriage and memory. And then I made this wholly accidental and huge discovery that led to my most recent book, Inheritance. But it was so instructive. I mean, what I found out through doing a DNA test that my dad, who raised me, had not been my biological father. And that after a lifetime of writing about secrecy, writing about secrets, writing about identity, writing about belonging and not belonging, you know, never really knowing why. And I always would have said, you know, when we talk about our themes, that writers need to be like a little blind or willfully blind to our own themes. Like I would say, you know, it's like looking under the hood of the car. You know, it's just your themes are your themes. It's just, that's your patch of land, right? And all of a sudden I realized like my patch of land had long been family and the corrosive power of secrets and what secrets do to us. And I realized that I was the secret. I had been the secret in my family. It was such a shocking re-understanding of my entire history. And I started researching and reporting and writing and thinking and trying to piece together this literally the story of like how I came to be.
Right. So you're writing a genealogical mystery from the viewpoint of almost like you know, you're investigating your own crime, you know, a crime that's been done to you years later. But it's fascinating stuff, and of course, it led you on a really kind of a thrill ride of a journey. But you know, at this point, yeah, given that you kind of know your beat now, as a memoirist and as a nonfiction writer, and this inheritance memoir was so well received, and obviously it was kind of very personal to you. But yeah, talk about like where you go from here and how you rectify, you know, what everything that you've been through up to now, and now what's the next piece?
Yeah, that continues to be really interesting because there's a few pieces to it, right? Like the fact that my 10th book has become by far and away the most successful of my books. And actually my 9th book, Hourglass, was also quite successful in terms of both its critical reception and how it sold. So I've had a really unusual trajectory as a writer. I don't think that could happen today in today's publishing world. I mean, it's a much less forgiving world where, you know, you write a couple of books that don't get any traction, you know, it's really hard to get people to pay attention, which is terrible. It's awful, but it's true. And I, you know, have had this kind of slow, steady build, and then suddenly this kind of explosion that also was a very intense experience because inheritance has meant a lot to a lot of people. And I did a huge amount of traveling for it. I think I had been to like 40 cities or something on tour before COVID shut us down. Mm. And I had never had the experience before of walking into a venue, a bookstore, a auditorium, a library, and seeing wall-to-wall people. Mm. Like nothing like that had ever happened to me before. And it was thrilling. I'm very grateful it wasn't my first book. I know people for whom I have friends who have had like, you know, uber successful first books, and then they think that that's the way it's always going to be. Mm. I know that that's not the way it's ever been or it's always going to be. But I've also had to kind of shed all that. And the pandemic has been a really interesting time of that kind of shedding for me. I mean, I'm still talking about inheritance, and I'll talk about it as long as people want to talk about it, because there's so many people making discoveries of different kinds of family secrets that that my book has meant a lot to, and I care about that. It feels like an incredible sort of purpose in this particular story that I'm the steward of. Mm. But when it comes to what's next, for a while I found myself really thinking, well, like the self-consciousness started settling in, and I thought, well, I have to write another nonfiction book. Look at this incredible audience that has all come to me because of inheritance. I mean, for the first time in a lifetime of not thinking strategically ever about what's next, building a writing life organically, I found myself thinking strategically, and guess what? It doesn't work. It leads to pale imitations of the thing that came before. Everything I started to write felt like it was a pale imitation, no matter what. I've thrown away hundreds of pages in the last 6 months, and that's fine because I finally have begun to make peace with the idea that it's going to take time. I very well may go back to fiction. which is not strategically a thing that anybody would suggest, but it may be the thing that is what calls me. And there alone is where good work gets made. And I know that. I know that as a teacher. I know that watching my friends. I know that as a writer myself. I know I've written a book that addresses it. But when it came to my own process, I really had to go through that.
Well, it's all pretty fascinating. It's been a fascinating journey for you. And congratulations on the successes. And of course, kind of the natural evolution of that seemed to be this podcast, which had such a fantastic reception. Of course, the podcast that I'm talking about is Family Secrets, which has just kind of risen to the top of the charts. And it's in its fourth season now. Is that right?
It is. Yes. It's midway through its fourth season. Yeah.
Congrats on that. And it's interesting
Thank
to
you.
Me, just given talking to you now and kind of how natural you are kind of on the microphone, that it translated to this pretty moving podcast where, you know, really you are getting others to share these pretty personal secrets and family secrets. And what's that like for you as an author? I mean, it's obviously some ripe, you know, grounds for spinning off into fiction stuff, but some of it's just so, it's very real. It's very cathartic at times, right? But what's it like for you looking at it from the other side and kind of being the, I don't know, you're almost like, there is that kind of, I want to say, confessional quality to the audio. You know, the warmth. I'm sure that if you're recording it now, you're probably doing it mostly remotely, but what's that like for you?
I mostly have recorded not in person, with my guest in another studio and me in a studio. Now I'm in my basement and my guest is in their basement or their closet or whatever.
Yeah.
But I love the intimate quality of, I feel like the conversations are so powerful, and they don't feel confessional to me. They feel, I feel very, responsible for this, for holding, containing, and shaping the stories of the people who come on the show. Many of them are writers. Most of them are writers, because that's who comes to me, and often people, I don't want to have someone on the show who's completely raw in the discovery of their secret. You know, I want, because what I'm really interested in is as much the storytelling of discovering the secret as the aftermath of the secret, you know, like what does it change? So many people, when they've had a secret kept from them and discover it, after they go through whatever initial, you know, speed bumps they go through emotionally, or I should say we, because this is true of me too, get to a place of feeling pretty liberated by knowing the truth, because the truth was always there lurking and kind of misshapen and toxic and, you know, kind of creating this feeling of like something doesn't make sense. And the other thing about the podcast is the whole thing. I mean, to go back to the idea of like organic storytelling, or, you know, the podcast did really explode when it started, because I think so many of us have family secrets or have, you know, the fascination with them. But that the idea for it came out of the fact that people just started telling me their stories, you know. Suddenly people were hearing, this was before Inheritance came out, but, you know, people in my life were hearing what the story was, you know, and they would start telling me their own stories. And I just found myself thinking, wow, these are amazing stories. I would love for people to hear them, which is how the whole thing, it was just such a natural evolution to the creating of this podcast. And I love doing it because it's a different kind of storytelling. It's, you know, going down in my basement, turning on my recording equipment, having an hour or an hour plus conversation with my guest, and then taking that conversation and shaping it into a 35 to 45 minute, you know, episode is just, it's very different from, you know, being alone with the page, right? It's a very different storytelling process, and it's fun to get to do something like that.
Interesting.
At this stage of, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, you're kind of, again, like a detective and a therapist all at once. And on top of that, I mean, I can imagine that you've had some interest in turning that into text, or, you know, turning the stories themselves into.
You know, actually, I haven't, because those stories are there. They are, you know, the people, the writers who have been on my podcast. I mean, I've been so, and by the way, just about no one has said no. Like, just about everyone that I've asked, or my producers asked to be on the show, has wanted to do it. And it's been, you know, people like, you know, KSA Lehman and Adrian Brodeur and Saeed Jones, and I mean, just this like amazing Nick Flynn, just this 2 weeks ago, Jenny Finney Boylan this week, Jennifer Finney Boylan, the amazing trans writer and activist. I mean, they have their own stories. And so I don't feel that those are my stories to tell in any way. But an exciting development, the podcast is actually being developed as a TV series, but it's going to be a fictional TV series.
Oh, interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
That's very cool news.
That's new news. And that'll be another way of exploring another kind of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's all very meta. It's all coming full circle.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, congrats on everything. You have chopped it up with some incredibly famous authors, yourself throughout your career. I mean, I could probably ask you what hanging out with Oprah was like, but I won't. Alicia Keys, which is very cool. But okay, a fun question for you. If you could take any author from any era to an all-expense-paid dinner to your favorite spot, post-COVID, of course, all expenses paid, who would you take and where would you take them?
I love that question. I'm going to say George Eliot. I was debating between George Eliot and Virginia Woolf, but I think George Eliot would be more fun.
Okay.
And we're talking about a fun dinner. So, and anywhere. Gosh, this is such a fantasy. I just want to kind of like revel in it for a while.
Take your time.
Well, yeah. So the place that I've been longing to be back at is the hotel in Italy where we do Sirenland every spring, which of course last spring had to be canceled, and this spring is up in the air. But it's a hotel called La Sirenuse, and they have this restaurant called La Sponda, which overlooks the sea and this magnificent view, and is filled with the most wonderful people. And, you know, the waiters and the maitre d' and the strolling mandolin players, you know, all of whom, you know, I've known for the last, 13 or 14 years since we started the conference. So I would like to take George Eliot to La Sponda and have her serenaded by mandolin players.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's in Positano?
Positano, on the Amalfi Coast.
Very nice. Well, there's some pictures over there at sirenland.net. Listeners can connect with Dani at her home base, DaniShapiro.com. Of course, I will link to this fantastic memoir, Inheritance, Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. And the podcast, Family Secrets, is in fourth season. Before we wrap here, your advice to your fellow scribes on just how to keep their chin up and keep going through this pretty challenging time in history.
I would say, first of all, to give yourselves a break and understand just how challenging a moment in history this is when, you know, current events are, you know, feel like they're straight from the pages of a dystopian novel, except we're living them. And I think sometimes in the face of that, it's very hard to feel that that your work matters. And I say that as someone who feels that, you know, on a daily basis, I have to, you know, talk myself out of that kind of, you know, self-censoring. What difference does it make? What can I possibly create in the face of this kind of state? I would urge everybody to read, if you don't know it, two different texts, and they're both available online. And one is William Faulkner's Nobel acceptance speech from 1950, mm-hmm. which was a very tremulous moment in history that he addresses, and he addresses making art in the face of it. And the other is Emerson's essay on self-reliance. If you read those two texts and kind of keep them near you and dip in and out of them, I suspect they will help.
Mm, I love that. And yes, those are both powerful. Great reminders. Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate your wisdom, your work. Where else do you want to point listeners to connect with you out there?
I would say the one social platform that I actually enjoy, much of a surprise to me, is Instagram. And I'm just Danny Writer on Instagram.
Nice.
And love to connect with people.
Perfect. And a great place to wrap up.
Kelton, thank you so much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on here and rapping with me.
Yeah, thanks for your great questions.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Writer Files. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review to help other writers out there find us. You can always leave a comment or a question and visit the entire archives at writerfiles.fm. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.